Choke points. Sound Transit has an $11.5 billion hole in its budget for ST3, and so they have to make some tough choices. What to cut, what to delay, how to make up the gap, and they would like your help. So, Chris, tell us about this.
All right. We've spent the last year discussing how badly the pandemic has resulted and the resulting recession hit Sound Transit's funding. Buying land and building massive projects is also getting more expensive. So now comes the time that they have to make serious decisions. It's what Sound Transit calls realignment. The agency's Jeff Patrick says the first move on the board is to make out and reach out to the federal government for some funding options.
We have a current presidential administration where there's a recognition of the importance of investments like light rail and getting people around without harming our planet, of getting our economy moving through infrastructure investment. So there are signs for hope that we do have some work ahead to figure out how we'll close that financial gap.
But even those federal potential dollars will only go so far. Even if they improve the bottom line a bit, Patrick says they won't fill the gap. So tough choices are going to have to be made. It's likely that Sound Transit will have to delay some, if not all, of the projects that it doesn't have under contract and under construction right now. It could also reduce the projects or build them in phases. For example, even though ST3 promised light rail to Everett, Sound Transit could start by going halfway.
The board could choose to, instead of going all the way, let's say, up to Everett in one fell swoop, they could do it in two phases. You could get from Linwood up to, say, the Mariner area of Snohomish County in the first phase, and then all the way into downtown Everett in the second phase.
This is just a hypothetical example, but it kind of highlights the potential ways to provide new service while securing and pushing the entire expansion schedule by a couple of years. And that's where the public comes in here. There is a survey underway through the end of this month looking for feedback on what the Sound Transit Board should do.
The board will look to the public to help guide decisions about how to realign our capital program, our plans and schedules for expansions happening after those currently in the construction, to bring our program back into alignment with fiscal reality.
And all comments and feedback are welcome.
If a certain project is important to someone, that's what we want to hear. If there are certain tools, as opposed, like, say, for instance, getting, you know, all the way there to the building and phases, if somebody has that view, we would take that or anything that's on people's mind.
And you can find the survey and the way to fill it out at mynorthwest.com. This affordability gap, as Sound Transit calls it, could go up or down later this week. A new financial forecast is coming out on Thursday. Now, the funding issue does not impact the projects already under construction. So light rail expansions to Linwood, Federal Way, Bellevue, and Redmond are all going to go forward towards their completions in 2023 and 2024. The Puyallup Sounder Garage and Tacoma Hilltop project also good. It's the expansions to West Seattle, to Ballard, to Tacoma, to Everett, that are in potential jeopardy right now, and they want to hear from you. If you live in West Seattle, you want to get together and say, don't you dare delay West Seattle, then tell them that. They want to try to get the best indication of what the public wants as they make these very, very difficult decisions.
Have they done an actual polling to see whether the change in pandemic working conditions, the change in people's commute patterns might change the need for some of these lines at all?
Well, I think since they're promised by the voters, their belief is they want to deliver what they asked voters for and were given. But that is a huge consideration and something that's been very difficult to forecast, as we've been talking about over the last year, because we don't know when that public perception and behavior is going to change. We do know that, I mean, with more companies coming back online in person, you know, this year, right now, going forward towards the summer, certainly people are going to start getting back into, trains and buses, but there still is some hesitancy. And so I know the Sound Transit Board is doing that. I'm not sure if they've actually polled riders, but I'm sure that's something they will be doing as they go forward.
Yeah. Is there still a reluctance to use public transit because of pandemic fears? Or are we pretty sure now that the vaccinations will make that moot?
Well, they're still seeing delay, certainly down in terms of ridership on buses and trains, certainly. It's better, obviously, than it was a year ago at this time. But there still is some hesitancy, even with vaccinations, I think, of people thinking that, you know, they don't want to get into an enclosed space with people regardless. But there are more and more people starting to use and come back again when it comes to public transit.
Right. And the reason that the gap is so huge, is it just because, I mean, obviously sales tax revenue is down. That will recover eventually. But what about the property costs and things like
that. That's also very huge. I mean, that has that, you know, that's one of the reasons why the Lynnwood expansion went up over $500 million mm-hmm. a couple of years ago, because buying all those properties through Shoreline just skyrocketed. And that's something that they are mentioning, what they call it, the upward pressure from the market in terms of construction costs of employment materials, things like that. That's certainly part of the factor. But Sound Transit, if you think about it, most of its funding comes from the sales tax. It's not really federally subsidized. It's not really state subsidized in any way. And when you've got everything in that one bucket and that bucket is empty, most of it kind of comes from the sales tax.
That's funny. And not from the license plates?
No. I mean, some people are not doing giving taps. So obviously there's part of that, but it's the sales tax and the retail that really hurt them. In addition to the fare box. But yeah, by far it was the sales tax side of things. And I know a lot of people that haven't been able to pay their tabs too, especially with people that have lost jobs and things like that. But the lion's share is on the sales tax side.
One more thing. Have they done any forecasts on whether those property values are going to continue to go up? Because there's always the risk that if you keep delaying, the property values get even worse.
Yeah, it's not going to get any cheaper to delay these things. We all know that. I think that's a better question for Matthew Gardner. Maybe they need to talk to Matthew about where things are going when it comes to the property taxes and the property values.
This is Yale's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Here's CBS News legal analyst Thane Rosenbaum. Thane, what did you think about the closing arguments yesterday?
Well, they both achieved what they wanted to do. The prosecution said case isn't really that complicated. It's a 9.5-minute video. We brought you a boatload of experts, many of whom not only wore uniforms and as police officers, but in fact served alongside and in some cases supervised Derek Chauvin. And we can tell you that was a disproportionate, unreasonable use of force. It was a tactic that is not in our manual. And you then had a whole series of different medical specialists who came in and said this man died of asphyxiation because he had his compression on his knee. That's it. It's over. That's your case. The defense came in and they spent a lot more time saying, whoa, wait a minute. Are you kidding? It's not about 9.5 minutes. It's about the 17 minutes before the 9 minutes. What happened when Derek Chauvin arrived at the scene, right? What did he see? The first thing he saw was three of his fellow officers unable to put one guy in a car, a man who was handcuffed. That's how it started out. He saw a crowd. He was in a high crime neighborhood, right? And what would a reasonable person do step by step by step by step? There were four cameras on him at the same time, including his own. What kind of an idiot do you think my client is that he would do illegal things knowing that all the cameras are on him, right?
Yeah.
I mean, these were the kinds of things that were being said, giving you much more complexity to the case. That's what the defendants wanted to do. So I thought they both actually did a very, capable job of, setting the story for the jury to deliberate and try to figure out, which story they believe most.
Yeah, the defense, Eric Nelson, basically argued that George Floyd had a pre-existing condition, which the officer couldn't have known about. But what does the law say about that?
Well, that's an interesting question. One of the things that he said, it's not just that he didn't know about it. It's that how can anyone know for sure what he died of, given the potential drug overdose because of the drug addiction and all of these respiratory problems, including three blocked arteries? How would a prosecution's expert so convinced that it had to be by asphyxiation? Yeah, look, causation is a real issue under the law. What is the cause of what was the ultimate cause of the injury, or in this case, in the death? Can there be a number of factors, right? And then there's one substantial factor that's really, really the ultimate, what one would call the proximate cause of the death. It's what made this case much more complicated. You can say, look, he clearly died of asphyxiation. That's what the emergency room doctor said when he arrived. That was the first conclusion I drew. But then they said, yeah, but you didn't, that time didn't know if you there was no autopsy. You didn't know there were drugs in his system, right? And you certainly didn't know about his heart problems. So again, these are the issues that make the case more complicated than the 9.5-minute video. That, Dave, and that historically in the United States, we are very sympathetic to police officers that serve in high crime neighborhoods.
Strangely, while this was going on, we got a final determination of the death of Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick, who originally was counted as part of the death toll due to the Capitol insurrection, but now they're saying he just died of natural causes of a stroke that just happened to occur the day after he was sprayed in the face.
Yeah. The real problem with that is that the press just didn't want to talk about that.
Yeah.
You know, that's the real problem with that. That they just weren't interested in that. It just didn't fit the story. And it's sad because, you know, I'm with CBS News, a member of the press. And, you know, when things like this happen, people start to lose faith in institutions. You know, what happened on January 6th, it had one direction, right? You know, everybody there was violent and everybody was there to, you know, to storm the Capitol building. And so, look, you know, it's the way, the way stories get shaped nowadays. You know, there's no nuance. You know, there's very little civil discourse in our country. People not only have fixed opinions, they have really, really fixed opinions.
Yeah.
And you really, really, really have to agree with them. Otherwise, they'll defriend you,
right?
You know?
But it's fair to say that what happened to George Floyd is substantially different than what we're talking about in the Capitol case.
Yeah, I mean, look, the difference here is the defense attorney, I thought, did a very good job of saying, my guy's not a bad guy. He's not a really bad guy. And by the way, there isn't a first-degree murder charge. There's no first-degree murder charge. So when Maxine Waters said, we will only be satisfied with a first-degree murder conviction, my first thought was, oh, boy, there's a problem. She just told them that they have to come back with a first-degree murder. They can't come back with the first degree murder charge because the prosecution didn't even bring that charge. So I think that's the real issue. On the other hand, you've got 12 jurors that live in a town that is the birthplace of the Black Lives Matters protest from last year. It started there. That's their friends and neighbors. So how does that play into their thinking? I don't know. You know, they know there's been protests over the last 5 days or more because of a shooting of yet another unarmed black man. Well, how does that play in their thinking? There's a fiction in the American legal system that jurors are blank slates. They have no feelings about anything other than what they're hearing in court. That's nonsense. Everyone knows that's nonsense. Everyone has opinions about everything, you know, so that when they tell you on voir dire, oh, no, I have no feelings about the police. Of course, everybody has feelings about the police one way or the other, or doctors or ministers or rabbis or, you know, everyone, you have a feeling. And so in this case, you have a real problem. You have jurors in a city that was on fire a year ago and might be on fire again. Now what do you do?
Thane Rosenbaum, CBS legal analyst. Thane, thank you very much.
Anytime for you.
This is Seattle's Morning News. A 50-year-old charity turns national parks into a classroom. Nature Bridge is Cairo Radio's Charity of the Month. Here's Cairo Radio's Heather Bosch.
Nature Bridge is a program that teaches young students about nature by bringing them into our national parks.
And they see learning in a new way because this is real-world learning. This is not learning in a textbook. This is learning in the real world.
Jen Kidder says in Washington State, students spend 3 to 5 days in Olympic National Park where they learn about wildlife, science, and teamwork.
It's incredible. We have students that lighten up in a way that they never have in the classroom. And that is just a very common thing we hear from teachers, that they see students talking and engaging more and interacting with other kids that they've never do in the way that they have inside of a classroom.
Educators develop the lessons. Some are planned and others, like the occasional raccoon or deer, just walk right up.
The teacher loses the attention of the kids. The kids all look at the deer and you just let the natural classroom, you know, just shine in that moment. It's really powerful.
Some students may pursue careers focused on the environment. Others may just gain a new appreciation for it and their place in it.
So many people over the years say that that one time at outdoor school at Nature Bridge just changed the course of their life.
Nature Bridge serves about 6,000 students in Washington State and about 30,000 at other national parks across the country. More than 45% of the students receive scholarships to attend these outdoor lessons, and for many, it's their first time visiting a national park.
Carita's Heather Bosch. 623 real-time traffic is brought to you by the Washington Department of Health, and here is Chris Sullivan.
Once again, our drivers on the state roofing text line 989-73 coming to the rescue to help me out. Tell me what's going on northbound I-5 as we work our way up past the Kent.
Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. The union that tried to organize Amazon workers at that Alabama warehouse and lost the vote by a pretty wide margin has now filed an objection with the National Labor Relations Board. And to tell us what's going on here is Mike Lewis of GeekWire. I think you used to work for us, right?
Yeah, I did used to work for you, but now I am doing mostly tech and tech civic related journalism at GeekWire.
Right. So what's the union's grounds for challenging the outcome of this vote?
Well, for people who aren't familiar, there was an effort to unionize the fulfillment center workers, about 5,700 of them in Bessemer, Alabama. And this is not, Alabama is not a real pro-union state, although Bessemer does have a history with the steel plant there. And so there is a union history there. The election failed not that long ago. But during the election, the union that had tried to organize the workers there, which is the retail wholesale department store union, they lost the election, but they had claimed all the way through that Amazon had done a variety of underhanded things to keep the union from or effectively organizing, and then also its own employees from effectively voting. I mean, the two broad categories of the complaint that they filed on Monday, intimidation of workers and then logistical impediments to organizing the workers that the union calls illegal.
One of the complaints I recall during while this vote was going on was that Amazon wanted to set up mailboxes near the warehouse where union members could cast their votes. On the surface, that sounded innocent, but maybe it wasn't.
Yeah, that's one of the complaints. You're absolutely right. But the nuance of it is a little bit different. What the union mainly felt was that the Amazon put collection boxes essentially where its security cameras are. And by putting them where the security cameras are, there was this idea that you would be seen voting. I mean, if you were an employee there and your manager was strongly anti-union, and many of the managers there were calling meetings to talk about how the union was not going to help workers there.
Yeah.
And you know your manager saw you vote rather than just not vote. That was something that I think the union really felt was a quasi-intimidation tactic. And when the National Labor Relations Board said Amazon couldn't put boxes in certain places, Amazon went ahead and did a bypass them, went to the U.S. Post Office,
yeah,
and had a postal box put right on the property as well. Another thing that the union is pretty unhappy about.
The camera thing's interesting to me, though. The idea, obviously, is to make sure that no one person is stuffing the ballot box, which would be in itself neutral, but then the camera is actually controlled by Amazon, not the union.
Well, both are plausible, right? I mean, certainly from the eyes of people who are organizing or strongly against organizing. But remember, from the worker standpoint and from the union standpoint, Amazon is famous for tracking every movement of its workers,
right,
in the facilities. And so they felt like that was an additional effort. It's like, we know what you're doing all of the time. And the union would argue that many of the people who opted out of voting did so because Amazon made it very, very clear, from signs in the bathrooms to in the break rooms to constant meetings with managers about the evils of unions. The union folks felt like Amazon was doing a fairly aggressive and in many cases legal campaign to thwart the union, because the laws really do favor on the property itself. The laws really do favor employers as far as the messaging you can do regarding unions.
So they're not alleging anything illegal.
Well, they're alleging certain things are illegal, but they concede that the laws definitely favor employers at this particular point when you're trying to organize or to have those discussions on the actual property. But here's the interesting part. One of the complaints also is that Amazon went to the city and changed the traffic signals at the entrance to the plant because you can't organize inside the plant. The union organizers would go up to at every red light and walk up to the cars and say, hey, we'd like to talk to you about the union, you know, on and on and on, maybe hand them, maybe get a phone number, do those sort of things.
I see.
Well, Amazon had the traffic lights shortened so they wouldn't be at the stoplights as long. Now, Amazon says it does this at all of its plants because it wants traffic to move fluidly in and out. And there's some evidence that Amazon has done this in other places, but the timing of this particular one right in the middle of the union organization seems peculiar to some people.
Now, that's interesting because if I wouldn't know myself how to go about getting the timing of my neighborhood traffic light changed if I wanted to. And,
exactly.
And Amazon was able to get it done during the course of this election campaign?
Very quickly.
Huh.
Very quickly.
That's
amazing. But Amazon's also the mayor in Bessemer is considered at getting the Amazon Fulfillment Center a crowning achievement. I mean, it is a town without an abundance of jobs that with $15 an hour, because their minimum wage is essentially tracks with the federal, which is half of that. And it's 5,700 jobs with medical and benefits and retirement benefits. And that's not, you know, easy to come by always in places like Bessemer.
So the local government apparatus clearly had a horse in this race.
I think as far as making Amazon happy and changing those traffic signals, perhaps so. But I think the mayor of Bessemer, who is also, you know, a native of Bessemer, I think that he probably worries on both sides. He has, I'm sure, friends who voted for the union, right? And he has constituents who voted against. And so what he did do aggressively during this election is not comment.
Hmm. So which warehouse is next? Or has this put workers all over the Amazon network on notice that this is going to be a real fight if you try to unionize?
Where it puts it is this. So the union doesn't feel like, or the labor movement broadly doesn't feel like this was a complete disaster. They did get about a third of the people to vote in a situation where they had very few advantages and a really small kind of underfunded union. So what do they feel like? Do they feel like they can do it elsewhere? Well, maybe. The argument against that, of course, is in Bessemer, where you don't have a lot of options, you can see how people would be scared. In Kent, for example, where you do have many more, the economy is much bigger and you have many more job options, would that actually help the union to put a little bit more pressure because people would leave? Here is the interesting thing, and this is one of the things that no one's been able to answer effectively for me. Amazon has a notoriously high turnover rate, employee turnover rate in every single one of its fulfillment centers. The one in Kent is right around 100%
wow.
annually. So, but what that does logistically is it makes it very difficult to have eligible people to vote for a union because you have to have been there a certain period of time and you have to be there. Even if you vote and then you leave, your vote's not counted. So if you are not there from the whole run of the election from before it so you can vote till after it, that actually means that your vote is never counted. And a bunch of votes in this particular case were put out. Now, we don't even know what they are. They don't open up those votes unless they actually need to be counted. And the margin of the ones that both sides agreed were legit, that margin was enough that you couldn't bring it. They don't even open up those uncounted ones that are perceived as ex-employees or not eligible employees. So all of this means that, weirdly enough, Amazon's high turnover rate, which I'm imagining is expensive for any company, may help them in this regard because it's really difficult to get a group of people organized and they don't end up treating the job as anything more than an 8-month interlude between other jobs.
Mike Lewis from GeekWire. Mike, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
See, so sometimes turnover is not a bug, it's a feature.
It's time for the Daily Dose of Kindness now. It's brought to you by Robert W. Baird & Company, Incorporated. We are often reminded that it takes just one person to make a difference. Well, in today's Dose of Kindness, one woman is making a major difference for veterans. CBS's Chip Reed has the story.
The monthly food drive at the Hanover, Pennsylvania VFW originally served 8 needy veterans. Now it's almost 90, and it takes a team of volunteers to pull it off, many of them vets themselves.
Hey guys.
It's all because of Christy Lucas, who after 17 years in education felt a calling to devote herself to veterans, so she created a charity, Roots for Boots. The goal is to give veterans whatever help they need, and she does it full time for no pay.
When you say it's more than just a food bank, what is it?
It's something that restores hope.
She's an angel.
She's an angel.
Hope for veterans like Vic Rowe.
I have a prosthesis on my left leg. He built a ramp for me.
And disabled veteran Jeremy Jacoby, who couldn't keep up with his young son.
He broke down, and I just
story gets me every time. I grabbed Jeremy's arm and I said, I'll get you that track chair by Christmas. And we did.
Veterans who sacrificed so much now have a full-time angel on their side. Chip Reed, CBS News, Hanover, Pennsylvania.
From the G and Ursula Show, which starts at 9 o'clock, here is G. Scott. I was talking with Fain Rosenbaum, who's one of CBS's legal analysts. He does not buy this idea that people who become jurors automatically turn into blank justice robots, which, of course, would be the ideal in a case like George Floyd's, because you're sitting on a powder keg. You know that whichever way you go, something's going to happen. Do you think that jurors can be impartial in a situation like this?
No. My mom and I talked about this yesterday. It's interesting. We had a long conversation about this trial and the deliberation, what we think is going to happen. And one of those topics is how in the world do you expect for these members of the jury to be non-biased to what's going on around them, not knowing what's going on in the media and the news? I mean, we are in 2021, where the technology is just incredible in ways that we've never seen before. You just don't just shut off. So those members of the jury are going in. They know. They've talked to family members. Now they're sequestered. Now is a time where they won't kind of get out there and pay attention to what's going on. So probably from yesterday until they come up with the verdict will be the time that they are probably not connected to what's going on outside of them. But until then, they've definitely been paying attention.
I'm just surprised they didn't move it out of Minneapolis. That surprised me. Such high-profile cases, you'd think they would. But I don't know. I think that in smaller cases, just knowing and talking to people who have been on a jury, I have never had the honor, things change. I mean, I think those that are chosen are chosen because they do exude this attitude of taking that civic duty seriously. They understand the consequences of not. But yeah, when you reach the level of a Derek Chauvin, George Floyd trial, it is hard to think that these people aren't influenced by what they've already seen.
Sure. And this is big, right? Like, what's going on in America is watching. We know what happened when we all saw the video of what happened. This is kind of, it's like, what was it, 30 years ago when you had the jury make the decision on the LAPD officers who beat Rodney King, and we know how that verdict turned out. There's few trials in American history in which some people can sit there and talk about, and you remember where you were during those times. In this case right here, what's going to happen from this will be a lot, right? There will be police reform because of this. Like, there will be different types of training because of what happened right there. So this is a huge deal. And to be honest with you, I'm more optimistic. I do believe that Derek Chauvin will be found guilty. My mom, on the other hand, who is 77 years old, thinks the opposite. And I know why. I'm more of the glass half full because I have seen less than my mom has seen. I get it with my mom because she's so numb to what's happened. I mean, my mom drank from colored water fountains in Oklahoma. You know what I mean? So just it almost broke my heart yesterday to hear her say, baby, it's going to be the same thing. You ain't got to worry. He going to get off. And wait a minute, my mom was law enforcement. So to hear her say that, it's just, I hope she's wrong. Actually, I do believe she's wrong. I have to think that way. It's the only way for me that I can get up every day and look for the best in humanity. I have to. I can't think that things won't get better. I can't think every single day that things will stay the same. I can't think about the fact that Emmett Till trial years ago when the guys, and they killed Emmett Till, and they were acquitted and let off during that time. And then we saw what happened with Rodney King. And so I have to believe that things are better today. I have to believe that things will not change to stay the same. At some point, this is going to change. Because if a video of 9 minutes and 27 seconds.
Well, did you buy the defense that said he had heart issues? I think I know your answer to this. That was the defense, that fentanyl and his heart issues is what led to his death, and not the suffocation. Some audacity to argue that.
That's why, you know, Colleen, that right there is my reason. That's another reason why I believe he's going to be found guilty. Because I feel like the defense was any and everything that the defense said during the trial. Can we, not just the experts, but we, the people, can see on the video and dispute everything that the defense has been trying to say. The fact that George Floyd said he couldn't breathe 26 times on video. So these things aren't like you have to have witness testimony and what the expert says. No, we can see those things. So, Colleen, my reason for believing that he's going to be found guilty is that right there, is the defense's deal of, well, he would have died that day anyways? Really?
Yeah.
With a heart
yeah.
attack?
And if he's not found guilty, does the reaction have to be violent?
No, it does not have to be violent. And anybody that says otherwise, then that's a problem as well. I don't even want to think about the fact. I can't think about the fact that the possibility of him being found not guilty, because it would hurt. I would say this would probably hurt more than the first time that I saw the video of George Floyd being killed by that police officer. A not guilty verdict would do that to me personally.
Yeah. G. Scott joins Ursula at 9 o'clock on Kire Radio. Thanks, G. Every Tuesday, we bring you David Farenthold live from the Washington Post. David, I got to ask you, what was Maxine Waters thinking when she made that statement to a WCCO reporter that Derek Chauvin has to be found guilty, 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 and we have to get more confrontational? I mean, even the judge was angry, saying that at the very least, when this verdict is appealed, which it will be if it's guilty, of course, those statements might lead to it being overturned.
You're right. If you know, this is not the place of a congresswoman to step in and say what a jury in Minnesota should be doing. I don't think it probably had a huge impact on that jury. Actually, one of the things that I thought was funny yesterday was the judge said that really nobody listens to members of Congress anyway, so it's not that bad.
That's right.
But certainly it's, you know, this is why we have the justice system, and the justice system is working. So she can complain if she wants to, if it doesn't turn out the way she wants. But to say she wants it to turn out a certain way now doesn't help anybody.
The final report came in on Brian Sicknick, and this is, I guess, somewhat related, because the defense in the Chauvin case is arguing that there were other things that led to George Floyd's death. In the case of Sicknick, there clearly were other things that led to his death. He was hit with bear spray by one of the rebels during the January 6th uprising there, but the official medical examiner's report said the bear spray had nothing to do with it, that he, I guess, what, coincidentally suffered two strokes the day after?
That's right. They declared it to be natural causes. So it doesn't sound like whoever they charged with attacking Sicknick, and which obviously he was attacked, and that's illegal. But it doesn't sound like it's going to be easy, perhaps impossible, to make a homicide case, to make a murder case, if they feel like the strokes were not related or in any way to the actions by the protesters.
Do you think the media behaved, because I'm already hearing complaints about this, right? Do you think the media behaved responsibly? But I think, because clearly everyone jumped to the conclusion that his death was a direct result of what had happened to him on that day.
Well, I mean, I don't think it was irresponsible to report that his death was connected to January 6th. I mean, I don't think we know that for sure, that that these strokes weren't in some way caused by the stress of what had happened the day before. The thing that I think was irresponsible by some folks was to report the this rumor that he had been hit by with a fire extinguisher. Now, this is a very that was a very chaotic time, a lot of reports coming out, and it was obviously a very chaotic scene. But I think people were really eager to rush and say, well, you know, this is how Sitnik was killed. And I don't think that any of the prosecution, any of the investigation so far has borne that out. He was attacked with bear spray, but the idea that he was bludgeoned with a fire extinguisher, nobody seems to have found proof of that.
What's the mood in Congress? I want to move on to the whole gun control thing now and police reform. We have this, of course, spate of mass shootings, which I guess is just something we've learned to live with. But, you know, every time someone says, okay, this is finally the thing that gets Congress to do something about gun control. The thing is, every one of these things is slightly different, right? I mean, in this latest case, for example, you actually had a chance at least to invoke a red flag law. And they did not. And so even though they sort of semi-invoked it by taking away this guy's shotgun, because they didn't put it in the data, there was no hearing, I guess, that would have put it in the data that's accessible to gun stores, he was able to buy two rifles. So, you know, now what do we do?
Right. I mean, so just to clarify, because there's been a couple mass shootings since then. This is the one in Indianapolis at the FedEx facility. You're right. Like, I guess that's an example of how difficult gun control legislation is, because one of the things that people have pushed as, okay, well, if we can't limit who's going to buy guns, then we should at least have a mechanism to take guns away when people show a proclivity for violence. And this is a perfect situation for that, where the guy's mother said she feared her son was going to commit suicide by cop. The cops actually visited his house, took away one of his guns, and then the system stopped working after that. And he bought two more guns, as you said, and committed this massacre. I think that's the problem with using these sort of complex after-the-fact mechanisms to try to keep guns out of the hands of bad people, is it requires a lot of action by a lot of people to keep guns away from these folks. And if any part of the system breaks down, as it did in this case, then the system doesn't work.
One of the things that everybody seems to agree on is, even the pro-gun people, is enforce the laws that we have. Now, Joe Biden has nominated this new director of ATF who rose up in the ranks. How's that nomination going? I haven't heard a thing about it. And is he the kind of guy who would actually crack down?
I think he would be stronger on firearms enforcement than under Trump, which is, you know, not hard. But as you said, the gun laws are, in many cases, state regulations, and it's up to state law enforcement agencies to enforce them. So I don't see the political will either on the part of the lawmakers or on the part of the cops enforcing these rules to really crack down. I just don't think that there's going to be much of a change. Unfortunately, given all the bloodshed we've seen, I just don't think we'll see much of a change in the way guns are regulated in this country.
Not even on the ghost guns, because I hear that these are the ones you can essentially print out at home, I guess, in the most extreme scenario, print out the critical parts without a serial number. And according to the reports I hear anyway, this is becoming more and more popular. I would think that even people who cherish the Second Amendment would understand that this would be perfect for a criminal enterprise.
You would hope so. And I think that you're right that maybe there's some action on that. That's a case where the firearms manufacturers are on the other side of this. They don't want people printing out their guns at home. But, you know, my home state of Texas has just gone through this fight where there are a few gun laws left on the books in Texas. And one of them is that you need a permit to carry a firearm. And the Republicans in Texas tried and failed in this legislative session to get rid of that, to impose what they call constitutional carry, which is basically like, you don't need a license, you don't need a permit, you can just get a gun. So if that's the way it's moving, I just don't see any movement that's going to materially change how many guns are out there, who has access to guns.
Yeah. On police reform, is that, of course, is also something that the states are more heavily involved in, I suppose, than the feds. But I know that there's been certainly some call beyond what Maxine Waters is saying for some kind of action in Congress. Is that going anywhere?
I don't see that moving very far in Congress, just because it's, you know, the 60 vote threshold in the Senate means that not much is going to get done. I think the Democrats are focused on other things, most importantly, infrastructure, that they feel like are critical to Biden's and their reelection chances, and that actually have a chance of passing because they can use a 50 vote threshold. So I don't see something like guns or any other police reform, any other kind of major bill passing the Senate this year that requires 60 votes.
Walter Mondale died yesterday, and I just wanted to note that for a moment, because the thing that I remember, of course, about him is that debate performance where he said that Ronald Reagan and I are both going to raise your taxes. He won't tell you. I just did. And to me, that was the moment where I learned that there is no market in politics for truth that the people don't want to hear. Because Reagan did end up raising taxes, and in some cases pretty substantially. And yet, after making that comment, Mondale lost 49 states. So,
yeah, I mean, it was, I guess, a useful exercise. Mondale was a very avowed liberal, and he you know, said he was going to raise taxes. And I think, you know, you look at what Obama did, you look at what Biden did, every effort to raise taxes, even on the smallest subset of the richest Americans, has been so hard. I don't think that, you know, there's any appetite for it in this country. And instead, we just run huge deficits.
Right. Which we're doing right now. David Farenthold, live from The Washington Post. We'll talk next Tuesday. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.